My name is Vidyadhaka, and I'm going to introduce Maitra Bandhu, who will then give a talk, and after that I'll launch, two books, which will then be on sale after the launch over there. So it's a real pleasure for me to be able to introduce Maitra Bandhu. It's a real delight. He's been a very, very good friend of me. In fact, the reason I'm here is primarily because of Maitra Bandhu. Well, the primary quality, of course, is that he is a friend. He's been a friend to me. He's been a friend to many, many people. And I think he really exemplifies the quality of friendship. He goes out to people who are new to the centre, and he takes an interest in them, and he encourages them, and he reassures them. He gives them what they need. He really befriends people coming along to the centre, really takes an interest in their life. And I can speak from experience, but I see Maitra Bandhu do that with many people, with many people at the London Buddhist Centre. He also, expresses and shows a lot of love with his peers. He really loves his peers. So Jnanavacha's sat here, and you'll often hear Jnanavacha's laughter echoing around the corridors and the shrine rooms of the LBC. It's because Maitra Bandhu stood next to him, and their friendship is that sort of friendship. And Maitra Bandhu really loves the people he lives with and his peers in the Dharma life. It's very, very clear. You don't need to wonder if he loves his friends. It's very, very clear. And of course, he looks up to Bante and others, many others, with admiration and devotion and indebtedness and gratitude. So I really rejoice in Maitra Bandhu's qualities as a friend, an all-round friend. And in this way, I would say that he's got a rigorous spiritual practice. He might not think that of himself, but I would say in this way he's got a rigorous spiritual practice. And I was just in the exhibition over there looking at some of the quotes, and Bante says, "If you take friendship seriously, you bring in, sooner or later, the whole of the Dharma." And I think this really illustrates how Maitra Bandhu lives his life. And there's another phrase came to mind. I don't know who this is. It might be Keats. Maitra Bandhu might be able to correct me. But Keats, I think, talked of spiritual yeast, and that with all of us, we have spiritual, as though we have spiritual yeast, and we just need to activate that yeast, and that yeast then, of course, is a transforming agent. And I feel like Maitra Bandhu has activated his spiritual yeast in his Dharma life. He's got a really, he seems to have a very, very perceptive and deep understanding of, like, the human mind and what it means to be human. He's very, very perceptive about what humans do. He's sort of seen it in himself, and he sees it in others. And so this gives him the ability to communicate so effectively. He's a sort of superb Dharma teacher, and he's able to do that so well because he understands what the human condition is, or very, very deeply understands that, and can teach from that point. He's also another one of his qualities is that he gives the arts. He's a bearer of the arts. So you may know, of course, that he has brought Poetry East into the movement, into the LBC. He's a published poet, which you'll hear about later. But at every level, he gives the arts. And I see him giving culture to, people, again, when they come along. I can remember Maitra Bandhu, on one of our first kind of get-togethers, taking me to the Caravaggio exhibition in the Royal Academy and standing me in front of a Caravaggio painting for about half an hour and just completely opened my eyes to art. And he does that with many, many people. That's a real gift, I think, a real gift of Maitra Bandhu. And he is going to talk today on... What's the title? He's going to talk about what good are the arts. So I think he's a qualified man for the job. And, I very, very much look forward to hearing what you've got to say. Sorry, I just wanted to include a fact. He's been ordained for 25 years and has lived and worked at the London Buddhist Centre for that time and more. And he's a very, very positive influence at the London Buddhist Centre in what he does and what he gives. And I really feel with Maitra Bandhu that he is a kind of a... how to put it? Like, he lives the lineage of Bhante's teaching. And I think he really, really lives that out, particularly at the London Buddhist Centre, but more and more through the order and movement. So, yeah, let's hear from Maitra Bandhu. Okay, thank you very much, Vidyadhaka. Can everyone hear me?
Hi.
No? A bit higher? Is that the best place for it? Can somebody help me with this of a 45 minute? Let's try the other mic, shall we? What good are the arts? I don't know whether you got that, but that was a kind of... That was very, very carefully choreographed. It needed to look really natural. I don't know whether you... Very, very carefully choreographed. That is actually the talk. I thought it was wonderful. I don't know whether you got it or not. Now, I'm terribly nervous to move, but that's part of it as well. You're a very forgiving audience. Okay, standing quite still in a mindful way, because I've also written a book on mindfulness. So I'll be very mindful during this talk. Okay, so in 2005, I tried to write a book entitled Making Art Matter. I tried to write this book entitled Making Art Matter. Whilst I was reading the book, I was reading a book by John Carey, the critic John Carey, called What Good Are the Arts? And as I tried to write a book about making art matter, his book was undermining mine step by step. Everything I tried to write, I'd then read something he wrote which argued against it and undermined it. I don't recommend it as a way of trying to write a book. So I tried to write it, and I ended up at a complete impasse and stopped writing it. In fact, I've never even looked at the book again. I think I wrote half the book. I've never looked at it again. I think I've lost the files. I ended up with two paragraphs I was happy with. Which is not bad for 3 months' work or whatever it was. So I ended up with a for the arts, and I ended up with a paragraph against the arts. And I thought that would be a really good place for a book on the arts to start, with a paragraph arguing for them and a paragraph arguing against them, both of which I agreed with. That's where I got to. But I realised I couldn't actually write that book. It would take a much better man than me. So I thought I'd just read a little tiny bit of those two paragraphs, which could have been the beginning of a book, but wasn't. And that's really the starting point for this talk. So then, for the arts have spiritual value. They refine our sensibility and sublimate our emotions. They help us discover a pleasure in higher things, such as art and music, and move away from lower ones, such as video games and drugs. Arts can communicate human values and qualities to such a degree that it gives access to the kind of heightened experience usually preserved for religion. Yeah. So that's for the arts. Against, there is no evidence to suggest that the enjoyment of high art makes people better, or that one's moral conduct is worse
for not having involved oneself in the arts. What studies there are suggest that rapturous ecstatic experiences can even make people more selfish. The theory that art communicates transcendent qualities undermines those who do not experience that. So that would have been a great place to start a book, but it'll have to be a place to start a talk. So that's where I ended up with, as a for and against the art. And of course, when looking back on Carey's book, John Carey's book, which I'd cautiously recommend, his basic assumption is that the underlying value of the arts must be social and political. I don't think he really has a consciousness of another kind of good. He assumes that the good of the arts is social and political. That's the basis of his argument, I think. I don't think he imagines a different kind of good. But what I found important about the book is its complete lack of pretension, its insistence that whatever good the arts might be needs to be put in context of the terrible world suffering. So when he's thinking about good, he's thinking about people who don't have clean water to drink and so on. So the good, if the arts are any good for him, they need to be put in that context of international suffering on the worst possible scale. So looking back on trying to write my book, which, as I say, I never wrote, the main problem that I could have discovered if I'd thought more deeply at the time is that the arts no longer arise from a complete worldview and way of life. That seemed to me the main issue, that when we think about the arts, we're thinking about something that has separated itself from a complete worldview and the way of life. So we're already in a problem, and you get caught up in that problem rather than realising that the idea of the arts themselves is a problem. Do you see what I mean? As soon as you say, what good are the arts, you're thinking of the arts as something separate, a category that's separate, and that's the first problem. As soon as you think about the arts, you're already in a problem. So the arts no longer arise from a complete worldview and way of life. They've gone their separate ways, as science has and history has and so on. The arts are separated especially from what I call very metaphorically the religious sense. This is something I've been talking about quite a lot, what I call the religious sense. And I don't mean, obviously, theology or belief, and I don't mean the mere fact of being a Buddhist. I mean a kind of religious sense, a mystical sense, a palpable sense that life has, or rather is, a spiritual issue. That's the main point. As soon as the arts is divorced from that, you've got a problem. So at the heart of life, beyond language, beyond symbol, beyond image, is an ineluctable mystery. That's what I mean by the religious sense. That just to look at our experience with any kind of honesty, we are confronted with an ineluctable mystery. When I say the religious sense, I particularly mean it in two ways. The religious sense expressed especially in ethical behaviour, in how we live and act, and felt in contemplation. So it's a directly felt intuition, a kind of atmosphere, a kind of way of being in oneself, and it's expressed in ethical behaviour, in how you live. As soon as the arts is split off from that, you've got a problem. As soon as you've got the arts, effectively, you've got a problem. So once upon a time, even if it's only in an imagined once upon a time, all branches of human thought and creativity grew from the trunk of this religious sense. That at the heart of life is an ineluctable mystery. At the heart of a life is this religious sense, that life is intrinsically a spiritual matter. So in this talk, I wanted primarily to focus on the separation of the arts from ethics. I want to primarily focus on the separation of the arts from ethics. I want to use just one little story to illustrate what's happened when you separate the arts from ethics. And this will have to count for many, many other stories, many of which you'll be aware of. So in 1963, the conductor George Solti famously recorded the Ring Cycle, Wagner's Ring Cycle, and won the gold medal, a very important medal, obviously, working with this recording with the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra. So he's won this incredible achievement. The Ring Cycle is, you know, huge. Conducting it, recording it is huge. He's won this gold medal for it with the Vienna Philharmonic. At the prize ceremony, practically none of the professors from the orchestra turned up. So he had this huge prize-giving ceremony for this remarkable conductor. Practically none of the professors from the orchestra committee turned up. And of course, they all had excuses. They were on tour, they were studying, they were in other cities. But the night before the prize-giving ceremony, a woman rang Solti in the Grand Hotel where he was staying, and she just said, "They are not coming because you're a dirty Hungarian Jew," and put the phone down. Yeah. After the receiving the award, after walking back to his room, the door to the orchestra's chairman was open. So that's where all the committee of the orchestra would have been. That door was open. And as Solti walked past the door, the missing committee members were all in there, having a cup of tea. So they'd basically boycotted the ceremony. They'd all been, all the excuses were on, they're all downstairs having a cup of tea. So that's what happens if you divorce the arts from ethics. That's the sort of thing that happens. I've been a bit involved in the poetry world, and there's much less of that in the poetry world. There's quite a lot of nastiness in the poetry world, I'm sorry to say. I was very disappointed to discover, just as there can be quite a lot of nastiness in our world, and we're all disappointed to discover that in ourselves and each other. So when you think of that with a Vienna Phil, these are gifted musicians at the very top of their game. It's one of the great orchestras, probably the great orchestra. So they're gifted musicians at the very top of their game, devoted to daily perfection. And here they are, somebody's phoning up saying they're not coming because you're a dirty Hungarian Jew. And this is the very country where the Holocaust was engendered, only a generation in. Yeah. So that has to stand as a kind of parable for what happens when you think of the arts as a separate thing to this religious sense, especially separate to the ethical sense. So this lack of connection with the ethical sense has afflicted all spheres of knowledge. This lack of connection with the religious sense, as I called it, has afflicted all spheres of knowledge, disastrously science, for instance, and so on. It occurred to me writing this, it's even afflicted religion. So, and it's even afflicted Buddhism, it's afflicted us, so that we can think in terms of secular mindfulness, even, horror upon horror, secular Buddhism. It seems to me sometimes the way some of us have spoken, as if you can have a secular insight, by which I mean insight divorced from reverence to one's teacher, insight divorced from devotion, worship and gratitude. So that starts to suggest that even Buddhism, starts to separate from the trunk of this religious sense, from this intuition, this hunch, that life has within it an ineluctable mystery that's expressed in ethical behaviour and felt in contemplation. So the first thing we're trying to do as members of the Tree Ratna Buddhist Order is to connect the arts back to the trunk of religion, to use that horrible R word, to connect the arts back to the trunk of religion. Only when the arts are connected to the religious sense can the arts be any good, in Carey's word. Only when they're connected back into the ethical, into ethical behaviour, into the religious sense, can the arts be any good, to use Carey's words. Yeah. Now, I don't mean literally, obviously. At Poetry East, a while ago, I was interviewing the poet Glyn Maxwell, a very good poet, and one of the things he was saying in the interview, he was saying that his poems are more religious than he is. He thinks of himself as an atheist, but he finds himself writing poems that feel more and more religious, and he's a perplexed by that as anyone. So you can be connected to it even against your will, simply. So in our context, that means connecting the arts, placing the arts within the five stages aspects of the spiritual life that we are training in. I've recently come back from co-leading the course at Gukiloka, the ordination course of 4 months. And what struck me there with a renewed force is just how demanding Bante's system of practice is, which is really the Buddha's system of practice retranslated. It's incredibly demanding. And I think it's very easy for us not to notice how demanding it is, how much Bante expects of us. Could be a whole talk in itself, but I better be careful. But it really struck me that we were practicing the whole system of meditation every day, but we were also committing ourselves to friendship every day. I was meeting up with people trying to be a friend. Particularly, I wanted to mention my friendship with Satyaraja. We met every morning for half an hour, talking about the retreat, talking about our meditations, talking about the Dharma life. And my friendship with him deepened so much just by the privilege of living and working with him. And living and working with Satyaraja in that way is part of Bante's system, that we live and work together, that we practice together. Friendship, ritual, even being in the countryside, even the idea of a retreat is all part of Bante's system. It's very, very demanding. In the morning, I was reading Milton. I was reading Paradise Lost. Johnson said, "No one ever wished it was longer." Anyway, I was reading some of it, and Johnson's quite right. You don't wish it's any longer. And I was struck that even reading Milton before doing my metta bhava and my sadhana is part of Bante's system. I was only reading book 9, and I'm sure that if I tell him I was reading book 9, oh no, read the whole thing. I've read it 3 times, oh yes. So, because by the religious sense I mean especially expressed in ethical behaviour, I wanted to try and look at the arts, particularly through the lens of ethics, because I think that is the thing that's most important at the moment to explore. So I thought I'd explore what good are the arts using Asanga's chapter on ethics from the Bodhisattva Bhumi. He talks about 3 levels of purification, and I want to try and talk about the arts in terms of these 3 levels of purification. Some of you will know these very well already from the Bodhisattva Bhumi. Some of you may not. So his first level of ethics is Samvara Sila. Which is best translated perhaps as the ethics of restraint, the ethic of discipline, of holding oneself back. Yeah. So this is where our ethics need to start, in an ethics of restraint, in an ethics of discipline, of holding ourselves back. So when we apply this to the arts, this means learning restraint and discipline in relationship to what we turn to for pleasure, relaxation and entertainment. I think it applies directly in that sense, doesn't it? That we looked for discipline in relationship to what we look for relaxation, entertainment and pleasure. And this really comes to meaning weaning ourselves off dissipation and dross. Facebook, watching endless DVDs and so on, Twitter, etc. It occurs to me that it's never been so easy to waste time. The 20th century is supposed to be the age of anxiety. My prediction of the 21st century, for us very privileged Westerners, is it's the age of time wasting. It's never been easier to waste time. I do it, you do it, we all do it. When you flick down the pictures on Facebook and see yet more photographs of snow when it's snowing. remarkable bits of literature like, "Today I bought a man bag" photograph. So this first level of ethics is weaning ourselves off that sort of thing. It's actually, even that is not easy to do. Actually, it's difficult even to get the tenor of this right, because sometimes a superhero's movie is exactly what you need. It can't always be Tarkovsky. Good heavens, not. It can't always be Tarkovsky, it can't always be Bach. Sometimes what you need is X-Men, or I recently went to see Mission Impossible. Mission Impossible. It was very good, but not intellectually top-heavy. So in terms of creating the arts, if we're creating, I don't know, poetry, painting, dance, singing and so forth, what this comes to mean is learning the forms. The ethics of restraint is the ethic of form. I wanted to have a whole disquisition here on the nature of form. I think there's something interesting about this issue of form. In poetry, for instance, since Eliot, the assumption has been that form is a kind of constriction, and what we need is free verse. So we've had, you know, heaven knows how long of free verse. In other words, without real form. And it gets very, very flaccid very easily. But it's very interesting that our ideas... I've been thinking, and it's interesting that our ideas about form and formlessness are also cultural ideas about form and formlessness. So the fact that people don't write rhyming sonnets in the traditional scheme is also one of the reasons why we like pure awareness. They're the same cultural force, yeah? Anyway, I promised myself not to say that. and it's not in my notes. And I tell you why it's not in my notes, because Jona Vaucher told me not to say it. And he's a wiser man than me, so you can thank him for me saying it. So, the discipline of restraint, if you're working in the arts, we're getting there, don't worry, is learning the form. So if you're writing poetry, you need to learn the forms. You need to learn to write in a villanelle, a sestina, you need to learn to rhyme, you need to work at writing in pentameter and so on. If you're painting, you need to learn to draw. Sorry to be all so old-fashioned. If you're writing, you could do it, at least learn to spell. Which for me has been quite a journey, isn't it? I'm getting there. Punctuation's still a bit iffy. So basically, if you're creating art, you need to learn the discipline of restraint. And you learn that by learning the forms, and you learn it from learning from the best who've written in those forms or painted in that way. Yeah? Okay. So the second level of ethics is Kusala Dharma Sila. So we start with this ethics of restraint, of holding ourselves back. And that's a difficult level of ethics for all of us. It's something that I'm trying to learn still. For instance, not saying unnecessarily controversial things at large gatherings. Not just because if I get a thought in my mind, I think, well, I'll say that. And then I get terribly upset if people don't like it. So I'm trying to learn the ethics of restraint, but I've still got a way to go. And as the talk goes on, if I get heated up, you'll find just how far I have to go. So we all need to learn the ethics of restraint. But most of us, when it comes to the arts, it means really laying off that really quite puerile level of entertainment and relaxation. But then we need to move up to Kusala Dharma Sila, the second of Asanga's hierarchy of ethics. And this is basically the practice of the 10 precepts. So I thought that how the 10 precepts relates to the arts basically boils down to trying to ascend to new levels of beauty and goodness. Yeah. So what practicing the 10 positive precepts means for ethical behaviour, for our aesthetic life, means ascending to new levels of beauty and truth and goodness. Yeah. In that aesthetic realm. Because for us, the arts are not separate from the religious sense, and if they are, we need to connect them back to the branch, back to that trunk. Beauty is truth, and truth is goodness. That only separates if you separate the arts from the religious sense. But I'm assuming that we're not doing that, so we're not making the arts into something separate to Dharma life. We're seeing it as part and parcel of our five great stages of practice. So basically, the The Kusa Dharma Sila, in terms of the arts, means training ourselves in aesthetic fulfillment. That's what we need to be doing, training ourselves in aesthetic fulfillment, deepening the aesthetic dimension of our lives. Because it's axiomatic that when we ascend to new levels of being and consciousness, whether it's through meditation, through puja, through friendship, through working together in a joint altruistic project, it's axiomatic that that is always experienced as being more aesthetic. Even when the working team is working really well, I don't know, setting up this shrine room, if it's working really well, there's an aesthetic sense to it, a real pleasure at working well together. It feels aesthetic. Any heightened, or if you prefer it, deepened experience, you know it's heightened or deepened because it feels more aesthetic. You experience a kind of heightened atmosphere, or if you prefer the other metaphor, a deepened atmosphere. That's when you know that a talk is any good. It's not because of the words the person is speaking. You won't be able to remember many of these words. But whether you experienced a deepened or heightened atmosphere, and that's to do with your aesthetic sense. What's interesting is that atmosphere, which is to do with your aesthetic sense, is not picked up when you watch the video. If you've ever been like listening to one of Subhuti's talks or Yonavarch's talks or many, many wonderful talks we have, you then go back to watch the video and some special element is not there. The atmosphere, the aesthetic atmosphere is not there. So in terms of the second level of ethics, Kusala Dharma Sila, it means ascending to this heightened atmosphere, which is aesthetic, looking for a deeper aesthetic fulfillment. As far as the arts goes, this means consciously cultivating higher pleasures, or, as I say, if you prefer it, deeper pleasures. It's really a matter of improving your mental and emotional diet, just as becoming a vegetarian is improving our diet, or becoming a vegan is improving our diet. It's exactly the same thing with what you put into your mind and heart. Yeah? Very sort of straightforward. But it's actually a difficult point to make now, because it easily sounds so sanctimonious, so questionably high-minded. Do you see what I mean? Very, very difficult to argue this now. Culture has changed to such a degree that even people who are very, very cultured, in the very best sense, feel almost apologetic about it. I once ruined a conversation at our mealtime for having the temerity to mention that I rather liked Mozart. You know, the table went quiet. We went back to, I don't know. I can't remember. Anyway. You see, it sounds questionably high-minded and it easily sounds sanctimonious. And I think in the past we've tried to teach this rather clumsily. We probably tried to teach a lot of things rather clumsily, and I've been part of teaching them rather clumsily. And it's easy, if you teach it clumsily, to end up pretending to enjoy things you think you ought to, and you end up easily feeling inadequate because you don't really. So you have this horrible double whammy where you pretend to enjoy it, to your friends, you could say Mozart like that with a slight lilt. You can talk about Titian's late style. Or if you're clever, you can talk about Titian's very late style. You get me? He was very old. So you can talk about Titian's very late style, whilst at the same time feeling inadequate because your conscience knows that you're not really enjoying it. So you have this double negative. And that's not surprising, that rather puts you off listening to Mozart or looking at late Titian. So I think mostly people need just more help with this. Gosh, look how the time's moving. Anyway, most people need more help with this. So one of the many things I was struck by on the course just now is, possibly because I was suggesting it to Satyaraja, we did one or two poetry evenings where I read poems. Not my poems. Actually, somebody asked me to read some of mine, so I reluctantly agreed. That was quite a late night. But they were marvellous. I mean, they were really good. Never ask somebody who writes poems if they'd like to read them. Just decide not to. Just skirt around that. Anyway, I was reading. I just decided mainly to focus on this one poem by Elizabeth Bishop, the American or Canadian poet. It's called The Moose. Very, very simple poem. Quite a long poem. Wonderful poem. A great modern poem, I think. And what I did, basically, is I read it, and then I said, just see what she's doing. There's not a full stop. It's a poem about a journey, and guess what? It takes her 9 stanzas of the poem to finish the first sentence and to see that a journey is like that. It isn't that striking that you travel a long way before you stop. And when the poem, the first full stop comes, is when the coach that she's driving on stops. And then when people get on, very short sentence when they get on, and then a new sentence as the coach sets off. I said, do you see how much she's thought about that? And then I said, do you see how she's used language to very, very subtly heighten the atmosphere until she's talking about something transcendent? Really quite incredible. And I was talking about it like this, and I'd even, as I was talking about it, discovering it. I hadn't thought that much about it, but as I spoke about it, and as the night was getting dark and the stars were coming out, But what struck me was how enraptured everybody was. Satyajit said, if you've managed to make me enjoy a poem, that was quite an achievement. Yeah? So I was really struck that by the end, everybody was enraptured by it. They really were, by Bishop's poem. Bishop had reached across time and space, across gender, to speak to a group of guys getting ordained. That's all that most of us need. We just need a bit more of a hander with it. Here's how you enjoy this more. Not why it's good for you, not why you should do it, but how you might enjoy it more. So this takes me down to say that this ascent, this going to the next level of beauty, is based in play, isn't it? The whole point of the arts is an adult play. The whole point is to enjoy it. If you don't enjoy it, it's not going to work, is it? You need a bit of help to enjoy it. That's the main help I need and you need, is help to enjoy Bach or Beethoven or Elizabeth Bishop. So it starts in play. So recently, just coming back from Gukiloka, I've been on holiday with my 2 nieces, as I call them. Too complicated and postmodern to go into. But I should be able to receive funding. I am so much the modern family. I'm so now, you know. Actually, it's a bit then, because there's lots of people like me now. Anyway, you can talk to me about it afterwards. So I've got this 8-year-old and a 7-year-old in my life, and we were playing Hello Kitty Top Trumps. I don't know whether you've ever played Hello Kitty Top Trumps. It's extremely boring. Anyway, and then we're doing all these clapping games, which that's the way. I like it. And there I was on the beach. That's the way. Actually, it's quite good. I remember when Alex was 4, no, a bit younger than actually, about 3, I think, and I sang Frère Jacques to her. Frère Jacques. And she sort of stared at me, and her eyes went bluer and bluer. And I got to the end, and there was this rapturous pause. And then she said, again. Frère Jacques, Frère Jacques. And then at the end, another pause. Again. Yeah. I did it countless times. Just an absolute wonder. So that's where the arts come from, is again. She didn't know French, but she's like, there's something going on here. It's like really again. Yeah? So that's where it comes from. We need to learn to play. If we're going to enjoy the arts, we need to learn to play. The arts is an adult play. And if you can't play in your ordinary life, which includes having a sense of humour, you won't be able to discover this deeper play, this deep play, which is Bach or Beethoven or whoever else. Yeah. Okay, 3rd level of ethics, Sattva Artha Kriya Sila. Sattva Artha Kriya Sila. This is the highest level of ethics, and simply translated, it's the ethics of benefiting sentient beings. Yeah. Sattva Artha Kriya Sila, the ethics of benefiting sentient beings. So this is the highest level of ethics, and it will take a bit of explaining how this pertains to the arts. So aesthetic experiences are what happens when the duality between subject and object lessens. We all know this. When the divide between you and world, self and world, is thinned, is attenuated. That's what an aesthetic experience is. So that from this point of view, any object can become an aesthetic object. I remember Sarvananda talking about a dream in which he saw a packet of gold silk cut, the gold wrapping on a packet of cigarettes. And it was in the dream, it was the aesthetic object. So any object, by definition, can be an aesthetic object for that viewer. Subhuti talks about seeing a wall in Italy. I've seen it through a tree or an apple and so on. When the usual boundaries between subject and object are overcome, even to a little degree, even to a small degree, a new kind of consciousness arises. So in principle, everything can do this. Everything can do this. I think that at the public ordination, which I was honoured to be in at Gukiloka, just the sight of the cases lying together, waiting for the public ordination, they suddenly become an aesthetic object. They are an aesthetic object. It's interesting that we instinctively wouldn't put them on the floor. And if you saw them on the floor, it's not that you just disapprove. You actually, you know, it's like seeing something quite wrong in the universe. It's an aesthetic sense, isn't it? So anything, everything can become an aesthetic object. So this thinning is the crux of the Dharma life. From the point of view, this thinning between subject and object is the crux of the Dharma life. It's what we're all trying to aim towards, except for aim is rather crude and sort of prosaic. It suggests it's a thing that you can arrive at. Bhante wants to talk in terms of we can hint at that rather than aim at it. So from this point of view, aesthetic experiences, along with our finest moments of generosity, our strongest friendships, our deepest moments of meditation, are all expressions of spiritual death. When that moment where the boundary between that separates me from world starts to be attenuated, self has died into life. Yeah, self has died into life. And it can be in a communication with a friend, in a meeting, it can be anywhere, yeah? Self dies into life the moment that that boundary is thinned. Yeah? You all know this. Art is one of the ways of doing that. And for some people, it's a vitally important way of doing that, of approaching this thinning between self and other. You're doing the same in meditation, you're doing the same in friendship, you're doing the same in generosity. They're all about thinning the borders between self and other, between I and world. So even though any object can in principle become the aesthetic object, art, particularly great art, seems to be peculiarly able to do this. Nobody really knows the reason why. In John Carey's book, he says that really art is whatever the artist says it is. So if I say it's art, it's art. But that might be all right for our personal preference. But why is it that Shakespeare is read so much by so many, translated, etc.? It can't just be a sort of plot for a class-riven plot or a sort of male-orientated plot. For some reason, it's very, very difficult to argue, great works of art seem to have a particular capacity to, if you're in the right mental state, and that's a big if you're in the right mental state, to help you cross the borders between self and world, between subject and object. Subhuti's been talking about this really remarkably. So this creation of the aesthetic object, whether that object is a painting, a poem, piece of music or whatever, has for many people been their primary source of coming into contact with the deepest currents of life. You see what I mean? It's been, for many people outside of the Dharma, it's been their primary source of coming into contact with the deepest currents of life. The philosopher, German philosopher Nietzsche, I was reading a philosophical commentary on his work, and this philosopher was saying that you could think of Nietzsche's philosophy as being all about how do you come to terms with the world when the music stops. He was a great lover of music and would sit and listen to music, and everything would be resolved in listening to the music. But how did you come to terms with the world when the music stopped? Yeah. For him, it was the access to the deepest currents of life. And it's been that for many, many people. My friend Manjusia. One of the reasons he got involved in the Dharma was because he went to a concert of Bach. And it's for this reason that it gives you this contact, direct contact with the religious sense, what I'm calling the religious sense, that life has intrinsic meaning. It's for this reason that we can't help ourselves still take the arts very seriously, because they touch the deepest point of our life. At their best and our best, they touch the deepest points of our life. So from this point of view, do you see how the creation and enjoyment of an aesthetic object at this level has been a source of direct benefit to human beings throughout time? There's countless stories of people being saved by hearing a sonnet of Shakespeare, by seeing a painting, by coming into this direct contact with the religious sense through the arts. Yeah, in that way, it has been a source of sattva arta kriya sila. It has been a source of benefiting mankind. That's why we still take it so seriously. Even if we don't think we should take it so seriously, somewhere we have a cultural memory that it can, at its best and with us at our best, break us into a new sphere of consciousness, which is remarkable. So I had a recent experience of this with Jan of Archer. We went to see the Meistersingers, Wagner's opera. I know Wagner quite well. I know the Ring Cycle particularly well, and I know Tristan and Isolde particularly well. I won't go on about it, anyway. but I didn't know the Meistersingers very well. I don't know why. It's supposed to be one of the great musical operas. It's supposed to be the most musical of the operas. Didn't know it very well. I remember Jan of Archer had even bought me the CD, and I kept on meaning to get onto it, and I never did quite. Jan of Archer got us free tickets to go and see it. We had a very good ticket. And there we were, sat there, with both, aesthetic object, here we go, aesthetic object. high art, etc. Because we're fine with that, we're fine with high art. Well, at least like, Jan of Archer's a bit iffy. he comes from a Hindu background, and it makes all the difference. So there we were. And the first act, absolutely terrible. Absolutely terrible. And Jan of Archer and I, then there's a break, and Jan of Archer, we're thinking, okay, this is supposed to be like one of the great achievements of Western culture. Absolutely awful. For a start, it's a comedy. And Wagner writing a comedy was not a good idea. Come on, Richard, this isn't going to be your form. So by golly, was it not funny. Not only was it not funny, I didn't just like it on any level. But it was really perplexing. We were talking about it in the break, saying, it's awful, isn't it? No, it's marvellous. Is it awful? It's like awful. No, come on, we'll be fine. Second act. Going to say, here we go. Second act, not as bad as the first act, but pretty bad. pretty bad. Musicians amongst you are now walking out. Anyway, the third act started. We went into the third act, and as soon as the introduction for the third act starts, something's changed. I don't know how Wagner does it. I'm not a musician, but something's changed about the whole thing. And then I could feel myself deepening as I sat there. Before now, we were thinking, if it had finished now, I would have walked out and said it was terrible. But, we got a free ticket. And we didn't have much else to do. This third act is a start. And my whole sense of myself to deepen. And then there's this quintet. So it's about, I won't tell you the story because I'm already over time, but it's about somebody writing a song, the master song. And he writes a verse of it, in the third act he sings this verse. It's fantastic. It's like spring suddenly arises in the opera. He sings this beautiful tenor aria, just one verse. But then, and he writes it down on this piece of paper, and he pins a piece of paper to what's effectively a clothesline across the stage. And by now, all these comic characters who you've been thinking, they're just mad, these people. They reminded me of us. It's like this village world in Germany, and they're all a bit frankly, a bit loopy. And I thought, who did they remind you? Oh, man. They get into arguments about nothing. They you know, they fall out with each other. They, you know, they try and get into each other's beds. Anyway, a sort of comedy of manners. But then in this quintet, they're all sitting down, these five characters. And all of those forces are suddenly unified into this quintet. And the quintet is just, I mean, I'd never heard anything like it. And as soon as it started, I burst into tears. And I wept and wept throughout the whole quintet. And what happened, in that the staging was perfect as well, it's so rare. As they sang this quintet, and the music literally takes the whole audience and just, you know, having said, we're just having a laugh, da-da-da, and just how silly we are, it just says all of that is part of this life, and this life can be lifted up. And it can be lifted up and up and up and up. And I felt myself and all of us rise to new levels of being and consciousness. And as I rose, I just wept and wept and wept. What happened in the staging, they did it perfectly. They pinned the paper of this song to this clothesline. And as they sang this quintet, the paper rose in the air. And the stage went darker and darker. And all there was in the end was one single spotlight showing this piece of paper, which has become the aesthetic object. This white square in the middle of a dark stage with this incredible music to the aesthetic object. And there I was, weeping and weeping. Afterwards, when Jon of Archer and I, we like staggered home like drunkards, I was in rapture. Afterwards, I was thinking, why do I weep so much? I remember I went to see King Lear once, a Japanese production of King Lear, and I actually wept from the first line all the way to the end. I went with Maitreya Raja and he kept sort of you're becoming an embarrassment. And I was thinking, had I not been so immersed in the music, I would have actually wept out loud. And my weeping, which is the deepest weeping I ever touch, is a weeping of being separate from that world. It was a weeping that as soon as I was being taken up out of this awful sort of polarization of life and world, me and object, as soon as I was taken out of that, all I felt was this unbearable grief of being separated from it. Being in it, I could feel my separation from it, and I wept at that separation, at being isolated in time and space, at being a mere me bobbing around in my egotism, when there was this music that wanted to take me quite out of the world, quite out of myself, out of time and space and causality. I wept like I've never wept before. And this is what the good of the arts really is. Though this experience is beyond good as we usually imagine it. So once we transcend, even to a tiny degree, that separates us from the world, the imagined self from the imagined world, we're spiritually reborn. That was an experience for me of spiritual rebirth. I entered for a while a transcendental realm beyond space, time and causality. And all I could do was weep at the fact that I'd been so locked within it. So silly, so foolish. So I wanted to end by, because it, as I was writing this talk, oh dear, I haven't got it. Oh, I wrote a book on mindfulness. Anyway, I want to end by thanking Bhante for it, because it's Bhante that we have to thank for our understanding that the arts are part of spiritual life, that the arts are spiritual life, that spiritual life and the arts are one trunk. It's Bhante that we have to thank. And one of the things that struck me when I was at Gukiloka, we were reading sections from his memoirs. In this case, we were reading sections from the Rainbow Road. And we all know the transcendent experience he had on Amen Corner. But we don't remember often that section that we sometimes read out, don't we? We don't remember that it starts with his experience of listening to Beethoven. Actually, if you look back at it, he starts by saying, as a teenager, I listened to Beethoven. It took me into such a realm that I lost all sense of my body. And what struck me rereading that, he said it is of the same order of these experiences that I vaguely want to call, appropriating in a suitably vague term, mystical. So that experience on Amen Corner, where he moves, you know that experience so well, he's actually saying it's of the same order of him listening to Beethoven, where he hears it afterwards. He says, for days and days, so loudly, so beautifully in his mind, that he loses all consciousness of the body. And that's the good of the arts. Thank you very much.
If you enjoyed that talk, you will thoroughly enjoy this book. So this is Mitra Bandhu's recent publication by Windhorse called The Journey and the Guide. And in the book, Mitra Bandhu takes us through the five stages of the path, and he speaks in three different voices. So, first of all, we hear from the guide, who is the Buddha. The Buddha is the guide in the book. And the way that Mitra Bandhu writes about the Buddha is very sort of, archetypal or even mythical. So when I've been reading those sections, I've been really struck by the vividness of the symbolism of the Buddha's life and how it relates to my life. You know, he writes in very, very sort of simple, symbolic language. Mitra Bandhu, of course, also writes in his own language, as a Dharma practitioner, his own language as a disciple of Bantai. And he writes about the spiritual life. He writes about what it is, and he writes about how to live it. So that's Mitra Bandhu, in a way, in his own voice, you know, with the humour, the intelligence, the breadth that we've just seen in his talk. And he also writes in a poetic way. So as you read the book, you come across sections of spiritual receptivity. So the book is broken up by pools of receptivity, and each pool begins with a poem and is followed by a short essay by Mitra Bandhu about that poem. And they're wonderful. They're really, really wonderful. I would buy the book just for those essays. On the other hand, if you don't want the essays, I would buy the book for the practical, modern teaching that you get throughout the book. My sense is, I had quite a strong sense that what Mitra Bandhu is doing is he's able to, throughout the book, hold the whole broad vision of Bante's teaching. Holds the vision of the Dharma, Bante's Dharma, and at the same time is able to be very, very practical, very, very straightforward, and bring the whole spiritual life just down to the essential. So it's not a meditation handbook. It's not a book about a particular set of techniques. It's a book about how you live the spiritual life, the whole life, how you live a whole life. So I'd really recommend it. I mean, if many of you will know Life is Full Attention. I've led that course several times. Many of you will have led it. When I've led it, I always take my practice deeper. I always find out new discoveries through leading the course and reading the book. The same will be true of this. So this is one book that Mitra Bandhu is launching today, and that will be on sale straight after this over there for £10. So it's usually £11.99, so today it's £10. And Mitra Bandhu will be there and he'll sign it. So you can get that book signed. I'd really recommend it. Very, very good. And of course, it's part of a course, so Mitra Bandhu will start leading courses. So it's invaluable, really, I think, for teaching the Dharma. And the second book I won't say much about, I don't feel able to, but it's Mitra Bandhu's publication, published by Blood Axe, called Yarn. It's a book of poetry. It's a book of, what you could call religious poetry, spiritual poetry. It's a book about friendship. And this is also being launched, and it's also £10, and he will also sign that today. So those two books are available at the counter over there. And I'd just like to thank Mitra Bandhu again for his talk.